three-way split. The left road was the widest and seemed to be the most traveled. She got down on her hands and knees and studied the rocky ground. It was hard to tell, but she thought that maybe she could see the indention of carriage wheels. But the middle road was wide and clear as well, with occasional dents in the ground that might be from the hooves of horses. Either one of these roads could be the road to Biltmore. Only the third road was different. It wasn't even right to call it a road, but what used to be a road. Two old rotting fir trees had collapsed, making an X across the path. Thick vines of poison ivy and smothering creeper grew all around and seemed to strangle the two fallen trees. This road obviously hadn't been traveled by carriage or horseback in years. She wasn't even sure a person on foot could get through. She didn't see any sign or marker that identified the road, but it seemed possible that an old, unused pathway like this might lead to the abandoned village. Maybe the state of the road choked off the town. Or maybe the forest took back the road when the townsfolk disappeared. In any case, if she had any hope of solving the mystery of the man in the black cloak, she needed clues and information. Where did he come from? What was his story? How could she stop him? Poison ivy had never affected her the way it did other people, but she still climbed carefully through the thicket of vines and thorns. On the other side of the two crossed trees, she came into a boskage of rotting dead snags with rocks on the ground as sharp as axe blades. The narrow, overgrown track twisted and turned and dove down into a rocky ravine, and she couldn't see what lay beyond. As she gazed at the darkened passage, a shiver went through her spine. She had no idea where it would lead her, but she started down the path. Chapter 10. Serafina followed the shadowed path for a while, crawling over fallen trees and through nasty thickets, until she came to yet another split. As she was trying to figure out which direction to go, she heard faint sounds drifting through the branches. The sounds had an eerie, other-earthly quality to them. She thought it might be nothing more than the wind blowing through the trees. But when she listened very carefully, it almost seemed like there were people calling to one another in the distance, and children playing. With no other clues to guide her, she decided to go toward the sounds and see what she could find. If she passed a house, then perhaps the inhabitants could point her in the right direction. The path led her around a sharp curve and plummeted into a steep, bracken-choked ravine. Then it climbed back out again, making its way among large, moss-covered rocks and old trees twisted by wind and age. Desperate for soil, the trees' roots clung to the rocks like giant hands, their massive fingers plunging into the earth beneath them.
"This place is terribly creepy," she thought.
But she kept going, determined to keep moving forward. Unlike normal trees, which grew upward toward the sunlight, these had gnarled, contorted branches, as if they had been twisted by agonizing pain. Many of the trees stood dead and bare, withered by disease or some other killing force. Still more of the trees lay dead on the ground, their trunks crisscrossing one another as if a giant had pushed them over. As she made her way, a mist rose up from the leaf-covered forest floor, and a fog set in that obscured her view of the terrain around her.
"Oh, great! If I can't see, I'm gonna get lost for sure."
She turned around to head back toward the last split in the path, but the fog became so thick that even this simple navigation was impossible. She tried to control her fear, but she felt the panic rise up in her. She gulped for air as the mist surrounded her, and she lost her sense of place and direction. She began to realize that she'd made a terrible mistake in leaving the main road.
"Stay calm," she thought. "Just think it through. Find your way home."
Her foot hit a lump, and she tripped and fell forward onto the ground. Her hands and face touched something wet and slimy buried in the leaves. She gasped when she saw that it was the bloody carcass of a deer or some other large animal. Its body had been eviscerated, its guts ripped out. Its head and hind legs were missing, but from what was left over, it appeared that it had been purposely cached here. She gagged as she got up onto her feet, wiped her hands on the bark of a slimy tree, and moved on, desperate to find the road. When she heard voices ahead, she felt a swell of hope. She moved quickly toward them.
"Maybe they're travelers," she thought. "Perhaps there's a hunting shack ahead."
But then she stopped in her tracks. They were the same eerie noises she had heard before. But this time they were much closer. Hoarse, raucous calling sounds, but with a strange, almost human quality, like some kind of weird children running and playing in the forest. A surge of fear swept through her. Her legs and hands buzzed with agitation. The sounds were above her and all around her now, and still she couldn't see them.
"Show yourself," she demanded.
Something brushed past her shoulder, and she whirled, crouching to the ground to defend herself. A burst of rushing air made her skin crawl as a black shape flew over her and then landed in a tree. She looked around her, and then she saw them. First one and then another. They were surrounding her. The hoarse croaking sounds came from a conspiracy of 13 ravens moving through the branches of the trees, calling to one another, speaking in their ancient codes. But the ravens weren't just conversing with each other. They were looking at her, flying around her, trying to communicate with her. As if frustrated by her lack of understanding, several of the ravens began diving at her with their claws. Were they attacking her, or were they warning her? She didn't know.
"Leave me alone," she shouted.
She covered her head with her arms and ran to escape them. She dove into a thicket of brush where the large birds couldn't fly. Driven by fear, she just kept running. When she finally stopped to catch her breath, she looked behind her to see if they were still following. She found herself standing on something hard, some sort of flat surface. She looked down and saw a long, straight edge of gray stone.
"Now what?" she thought.
It was half buried, but she knelt on the ground and wiped away the dirt and leaves to expose the smooth, flat granite underneath. Serafina read the words that someone had etched in blocky letters into the stone.
"Here lies blood, and let it lie, speechless still, and never cry."
She felt a cold sweat pass over her. She looked around. There was another flat gray stone just a few feet away. She pulled the brush aside and read,
come hither, and lay with me. We'll murder the man who murdered me. Cloven Smith, 1797 to 1843. All right. I don't like this place at all. These are graves."
She wiped her clammy hands on her shirt. Then she took a few more steps, finding more graves beneath the undergrowth of the forest. The graveyard seemed like it went on and on. There were graves as far as she could see, most of them overgrown with vines and trees. Many of the headstones were so close together that they couldn't possibly have bodies beneath them, just like the stories she'd heard. It was as if people had gone missing, their bodies never found, and these were but markers of the lost. But as she delved deeper into the oldest parts of the abandoned cemetery, she saw mounds where bodies had definitely been buried, and other graves that were empty holes, as if the coffins had been plundered or the dead had crawled out of the ground on their own. She swallowed hard and tried to keep moving despite the trembling in her limbs. In some places, the layers of earth appeared as if they had shifted, exposing broken, rotting coffins to the air. Some of the coffins jutted up out of the earth, or were tangled beneath gnarled tree roots. She kept walking and reading the stones. 100 years of old people, young people, brothers and sisters, friends and enemies, husbands and wives. She had heard stories about this old cemetery, filled with hundreds of gravestones and monuments, even though no one alive could remember burying the people. Many of the local mountain folk wondered where all the dead people in this cemetery had come from. Whole families seemed to have perished in short spans of time. There were tall tales that the mountain folk no longer used this cemetery, because burying your loved ones here didn't necessarily guarantee that they would stay. The coffins shifted in the unstable earth. The bodies went missing. Your dead loved ones were seen wandering their old homes and streets, as if searching for a place to rest. There were tales, too, of human beings shifting into the shape of wild animals, of sorcerers and witches with surpassing power, and horrible disfigured creatures crawling through the forest. She came upon two small mounds so close together, side by side, that they were nearly a single grave. One tombstone identified the two young sisters within. "Our bed is lovely, dark, and sweet. Come join us now, and we shall meet. Mary Hemlock and Margaret Hemlock, 1782 to 1791. Rest in peace, and don't return." When she read the words, "Don't return," the hairs on the back of her neck tingled. What kind of strange place was this? She had come in search of an old village, but all she'd found was its cemetery. She had a feeling that this was all that was left. As Serafina walked, the dry autumn leaves crunched beneath her feet. Tree branches lay like emaciated dead fingers on the ground among the gravestones and monuments. Many of the monuments had toppled to the earth and lay broken and strewn, while others had sunk deep into the ground. A few of the gravestones remained standing, sticking up several feet with spires or crosses, but they were so thickly covered in black and green moss and overgrown with vines that they were nearly indistinguishable from the wretched forest around them. She read another. "Death is a debt to nature due, which I have paid, and so will you." In another area, she found row upon row of crosses. An old weathered plaque explained that these 66 crosses were the graves of an entire company of Confederate soldiers who were found dead one night, even though they never fought in any battle. Farther on, Serafina came to a glade. A little clearing in the trees, strangely without bushes, vines, or undergrowth of any kind. This one particular part of the cemetery had not become overgrown, but remained an area of perfect green grass. In the center of the glade stood a stone monument carved into the likeness of a winged angel. Stranger still was the fact that although there was fog all around the glade, there was no fog in the glade itself. Sunlight filtered through the mist and illuminated the angel's face and hair and wings with a gentle light.
"Now she's pretty," Seraphina said as she stepped closer and read the inscription on the pedestal of the statue. "Our character isn't defined by the battles we win or lose, but by the battles we dare to fight." Seraphina looked up at the angel and studied her. Dappled layers of green and gray moss and lichen covered the angel, and the black streaks of 100 years of aging stained her long dress and her beautiful face. Dark tears seemed to be falling down her cheeks, as if she had known great sadness. But her wings stretched upward into a fury, her head raised into an apocalyptic cry, as if calling those around her into a great battle.
"What kind of battle?"
Seraphina wondered. In her right hand, the angel held a sword. The statue itself was made of stone, but the sword appeared to be made of steel, and the metal gleamed as if it was untouched by time. Curious, Seraphina slowly reached out her hand and touched the edge of the blade. She gasped and pulled back, blood oozing from her finger. The edge of the sword was razor sharp. Then something caught her eye. She felt a pulse of fear. Her muscles tightened, readying themselves to flee. At the edge of the glade, a gravestone had tumbled over where a gnarled old willow tree had fallen, and its upturned roots had created a small cave. She wasn't sure, but she thought she saw one of the shadows slowly move. Then she was sure of it. There was something stirring by the old grave. Chapter 11. Seraphina had to remind herself to keep breathing, to stay calm. She felt her chest tightening, her breaths getting shorter and shorter. She wanted to turn and run, but she stayed and watched, her curiosity too strong to overcome. She crept quietly through the graveyard to get a closer look. She feared it might be a corpse crawling out of the ground. She imagined its rotting white hands digging through the dirt as it broke the surface. But as she got closer, she realized it wasn't a corpse at all, but a very living creature. It was some sort of small wildcat with yellowish-brown fur, black spots and markings, and a long tail. It took her several seconds to figure out that it was a baby mountain lion. Suddenly, a second lion cub appeared. They charged each other, grabbing each other with their paws and tumbling in play, meowing and howling and swatting each other. They had the most adorable little yellow faces marked with black streaks and spots and long white kitty whiskers. Smiling, Seraphina watched the cubs play in the bright green grass of the Stone Angel's sunlit glade. The fear she had felt just moments before began to melt away. She had always loved kittens. She crouched down and moved a little closer. One of the cubs spotted her. Its ears perked up, and it stared at her, studying her. She thought that it would run away in fear, but it didn't. It gave her a raspy meow and ambled toward her as if it didn't have a care in the world. She extended her arm, holding her hand still. The brave little cub slowed down, but it kept coming toward her, watching her, inching closer and closer. When it reached her, it sniffed her fingers and rubbed the side of its mouth along the length of her hand. Serafina smiled, almost giggled, pleased that the cub didn't fear her. She sat down in the grass, and the cub climbed right into her lap, pawing playfully at her fingers. She wrapped her arms around the cub and hugged its warm, fuzzy little body to her chest. It was good to have some company that didn't scare the living daylights out of her. The other cub came over, and soon she was loving on both of them as they tumbled and rolled around her, and they rubbed themselves against her and purred.
"What are you sweet little babies doing here?" she asked.
After all she'd been through, it felt more than agreeable to be accepted by these wonderful little creatures. It felt like a homecoming. Soon, they were all up and about. She chased the cubs around the glade, pretending to swat at them with her paw. Then they chased her. She got down on her hands and knees. One of the cubs ran behind the pedestal of the stone angel, came around the other side, and peeked at her, his dark little eyes blinking as he pretended to stalk her. He darted out playfully, running sideways with his back arched into a mock attack as he leapt upon her. Then the other cub joined in, grabbing her arms and legs, trying to tackle her. And soon they were all brawling and growling. The adorable kittenish attack made Serafina laugh out loud, and her laughter carried through the misty forest. She kept playing and wrestling with the cubs, feeling a pure and oblivious childlike pleasure that she hadn't felt in a long time. Then she sensed severe and immediate danger. She turned and saw something hurtling toward her out of the mist. At first, it seemed to be floating like a ghost. But then she realized it wasn't a ghost at all. It was running fast, straight toward her. A wave of dread washed through her as she realized that by playing with these cubs, she'd made a terrible, terrible error in judgment. The angry, full-grown mother mountain lion charged toward her. The lioness would kill her to defend her cubs. Fear jolted Serafina into motion. The lioness leapt through the air, her claws and teeth bared. Serafina knew she was going to die, but she tried to duck. The impact of the lioness's attack slammed into her so hard that it knocked her off her feet. She and the vicious beast tumbled across the grass in a brawling, snarling mass of hissing teeth and claws. Serafina battled with all her strength. She had never in her life fought anything so physically powerful. She knew there was no way to defeat her. She was but a kitten compared to this wild beast. Her only hope was to get away as fast as she could. She kicked her feet and flailed her fists. She beat the lioness with a stick, screaming all the while. When the lioness tried to bite her neck and deliver her deadly blow, Serafina slammed her hands into the lioness's face and tore at her eyes, then whirled herself into a wild, twisting frenzy. Her attacks distracted the big cat just long enough to break herself free. Then she sprang up and darted away like a scalded dog. The lioness chased her, but Serafina sprinted with an incredible burst of fear-induced speed. She scrambled into the thick bushes like a squirrel and just kept running. She ran and she ran. She ran until her whole chest hurt with thumping pain. She crossed a rocky stream, then went through a thick stand of pines, and then delved into a thicket of thistles and blackberry thorns. She climbed up hills and over rocks and just kept running as far as she could. Finally, exhausted, she ducked beneath a bush like a rabbit and listened for the sounds of her pursuer. She did not hear her.
She imagined that the lioness, satisfied that she had chased off the intruder, had returned to her cubs. She could picture the mother lion scolding them for playing with a stranger and pushing them angrily back into their den beneath the roots of the tree. Panting and wounded, Serafina pressed on through the forest, determined to put as much distance as possible between her, the cemetery, and the mountain lion's den. She vowed to never return to that terrifying place. When she finally stopped for a moment to catch her breath, she looked around her. Nothing looked familiar. It was then that she realized that she was completely and utterly lost. Chapter 12. Serafina kept moving, and soon found herself traveling along the top edge of a rocky, tree-covered ridge. In her panic to escape the lioness, it seemed that she'd run halfway up a mountain. Exhausted, she finally stopped to rest and check her wounds. Her clothing had been torn. The length of twine that once held her paw's shirt around her body had broken and was gone. Claw marks sliced her arms and legs. Her head hurt. Several tooth marks punctured her chest. She was pretty torn up, but it wasn't nearly as bad as she had expected. "It hurts, but I'm gonna live," she thought, "assuming I can find my way home." She had thought that the forest couldn't be nearly as bad as her pa described, but it turned out to be a far darker, more dangerous place than she'd ever imagined. With everything she'd seen so far, she didn't think she could survive another night here. But she was still miles from the house, stuck on a ridge, and she didn't even know which direction to go. She looked up at the dark, cloudy sky, trying to find the position of the sun. Then she scanned the surrounding landscape for clues and landmarks. With no compass, no map, and no idea where she was in relation to Biltmore Estate, how could she make sure she was going in the right direction? She was already cold when it started raining. "Oh, great," she said, shouting up at the clouds. "Thank you. That's really nice, you stupid sky." She hated getting wet. This was a miserable place. She just wanted to get home. She missed her pa something awful. She longed for a glass of milk, a piece of fried catfish, a warm little cook fire in the workshop, and her dry, cozy bed behind the boiler. Yesterday she'd been slinking gracefully across the plush carpets of Biltmore's elegant rooms, and today she was stuck out in the cold, wet, stupid, raining world. As the rain poured down, she tried to hide under the boughs of a pine tree, but it didn't help. The big drips onto her sopping head and neck just made her more miserable. Rivulets of water flowed across the rocky ground beneath her. Wet and bedraggled, she clung to the trunk of the tree, terrified that she'd slip down the steep slope of the mountainside. She wanted her pa to get his ladder and rescue her, like he had when she was little, but she knew he wouldn't even know where to look for her. Then, as she watched the water trickle across the ground, a thought occurred to her. Water runs downhill, downhill, and into rivers. She had been following the contour of the ridge because it had been easiest, but now she had a different idea. What if she climbed straight down the steepest slope of the mountain and used the trunks of the trees and the branches of the rhododendrons as a sort of ladder? She'd get down a lot quicker. She stepped closer to the edge and peered tentatively over the cliff. It was a long way down, but she grabbed the first branch to see if it would hold her. Suddenly, her foot slipped in the wet leaves, her fingers broke free from the branch, and she plummeted down the mountainside. The swooping sensation of freefall instantly filled her entire body. She slid down feet first, screaming. She tried to stay upright and reached out for the bushes to break her fall. But then she hit a tree trunk, and it knocked the wind out of her. She pitched in one direction, then the next, hurtling down the mountain. She hit a branch. She spun. She hit a rock. She plunged. Suddenly, she was somersaulting end over end. All the while, she fell, tumbling down the mountainside in a great wave of autumn leaves. The rush of speed and the wind against her face made her feel like she was flying. But then she hit another tree, the force slamming a painful grunt from her chest, and she flipped and rolled until she finally crashed, breathless and hurting, at the bottom of the ravine. She lay there for several seconds, unable to move. Her whole body hurt. She'd been punched and battered and stabbed. "Well, that was one way to get down," she groaned. When she was finally able to get on her feet, she brushed herself off and limped on her way. She followed a small stream that trickled into a creek. Thirsty, she lay flat at the stream's edge and lapped up the clear mountain water like an animal. The stream led her to a waterfall that crashed into a tumultuous pool 30 feet below. "Does this waterfall have a name?" she wondered. If she knew that, then maybe it would help her understand where she was and give her a better chance of finding her way home. "What river is this?" But then she realized that it didn't matter exactly where she was. A river wasn't a place. A river was movement. She remembered something her pa had taught her. All the rivers in these mountains wound through complicated twisting routes, but eventually they all flowed in one direction, into the mighty French Broad River. The Blue Ridge Mountains were some of the oldest mountains in the world. The river had been flowing here for millions of years, and it helped shape the mountains into what they were today. And, most importantly, she knew that the French Broad River flowed through the grounds of Biltmore Estate, right past the mansion. The river was the way home. She climbed down the wet, slippery rocks at the edge of the waterfall, then made her way along the craggy shoreline. Confident in her direction now, she traveled as fast as she could. She had to reach her pa, who she knew must be worried sick about her, and she wanted to see Braden. She wasn't sure if she had abandoned him by sneaking into the woods, or if he'd abandoned her by going home in his uncle's carriage. But they'd separated, and it made her stomach hurt. The more time that went by, the less certain she became of how she should feel. Was Braden actually her friend? Or was her mind just imagining it, like when she imagined herself as being friends with the butler's assistant who stopped and ate the cookies? All her life, she had pretended that she had friends. But was it true this time? She and Braden had only known each other for a short while, but she let the memories of their time together wash over her. To someone like her, it felt like a lifetime of friendship. She was like a starved animal wolfing down a scrap and thinking it had eaten a full meal. But she had no idea if he missed her the way she missed him. She walked for hours, following the river until it flowed into a much wider, flatter river that she hoped was the French Broad, but she wasn't sure. She was tired, hungry, and sore from her wounds. She just wanted to get home. As the sun slowly withdrew behind the trees in the western sky, she tried to push herself faster. She didn't want to get caught in the forest another night, for that's when the mountain lion, the man in the black cloak, and whatever other demons might crawl out of the cemetery would be on the prowl. But it was no use. The sun abandoned her. The birds and the other daytime sounds went dead, and the darkness settled into the trees like a black oil. Exhausted, she stopped to catch her breath and rest a spell. She knew it was dangerous to linger in the open. Wet and shivering, she crawled into a hole beneath the hollowed roots of a tree at the river's edge, curled into a little ball, and peered out into the darkness. She was a failure. That's what she thought. She had come to the forest to see the world, but all she'd found was wretchedness. From her little cave beneath the roots, she looked downstream along the gravelly shore of the river. The air around her was cold and still, but the river rippled with a steady rushing sound, and she could taste its moisture on her lips. The waxing moon rising above the mountains cast a silvery light across the deep-flowing black water. Mist oozed out of the forest and drifted across the river like a legion of ghosts. A wolf called in the distance, a long, plaintive, lonely howl that put a shiver up her spine. The wolf was miles away, up on the mountains. But then, she nearly jumped out of her skin, when a much closer wolf answered the call with a returning howl. Red wolves were elusive, almost mythological beasts, seldom seen by anyone. But they were well known for being fierce warriors that fought in packs, tearing their enemies with their gleaming white fangs. The wolf close to her howled again, and a dozen wolves on the other side of the river lit up the air with a blood-curdling chorus of howls. Goosebumps rose on her arms. She did not hear it approach, for it moved like a ghost through the mist. But she saw the wolf come slowly out of the forest and look out across the river. She stayed very still among the roots and watched it. She could smell the musky scent of its coat and see its moonlit breath in the air. It was a young wolf, long and lean, with a deep coat of reddish-brown fur, a slender nose, and tall ears. The fur on its right shoulder was bloody from a wound. She held her breath and stayed quiet. "The wolf doesn't know I'm here," she thought. "I'm one with the forest. I'm camouflaged and silent." But then the wolf turned its head and looked straight at her, its eyes as keen and penetrating as any creature she had ever seen. Her muscles bunched as she prepared herself for the attack. But then the wolf's ear twitched. Serafina heard it too. There was something large moving through the forest, traveling along the river shore toward them. The wolf looked in the direction of the sound, and then he looked back at her. He stared at her for several seconds, even as the sound moved toward them. Then, to her astonishment, the wolf walked into the river. He kept walking until he was up to his shoulders in the water. Then the river swept him away, and all she could see was his head as he tried to fight against the current. He was swimming toward the howls of his brothers and sisters on the other side of the river, and he was swimming away from the thing coming toward her. Suddenly, she felt abandoned, vulnerable. The river made too much noise for her to hear exactly what was coming toward her, but it was getting closer. Sticks breaking,
Footsteps. 2 feet.
It wasn't the mountain lion or another wolf that had scared the red wolf across the river, but a man. Was it the man in the black cloak? As she huddled down into the dirt, a hideous giant centipede crawled across her hand. She flinched and stifled a scream. Her lungs demanded more air. Her legs tensed, wanting her to run. But it was too late. The attacker was too close. A smart rabbit doesn't break cover when the predator is upon her. She hides. She pushed herself farther back into the dark little hole beneath the roots. A flickering light came through the trees. She heard the pushing of bushes and the scraping of bark and the muffled clanking of metal and wood.
It's a lantern, she thought. The same kind of lantern the man in the black cloak used the night he took Clara Brahms.
Trembling, she crouched low and readied herself for battle. Chapter 13. Serafina watched the man raise his lantern and look around him as he broke through the underbrush. It was clear that he was searching for something, but more than that, he was frightened. Even with his lantern and the nearly full moon, he could not see as well in the forest's darkness as she could. When the man took another step, she recognized the familiar creak of his leather work boot. That's when she realized that it wasn't the man in the black cloak. It was her pa, in a long dark brown weather cloak. Despite his warnings and despite his fear, he had delved deep into the forest to rescue her. She gasped, crawled out of her hole, and ran toward him. I'm here, Pa. I'm here, she stammered, crying as she threw her arms around him. He squeezed her tight for a long time. It was like being hugged by a gentle bear. She clung to his huge, warm body. As he exhaled in relief, she could feel the shattering worry pouring out of him.
Sarah, oh, Sarah, I thought you'd disappeared like the other children.
I ain't disappeared, Pa, she said, her voice quivering like she was a little girl again.
Seeing her torn clothing and the scratches on her arms, even in the poor light of his lantern, he asked,
What happened to you, Sarah? You have another run-in with a raccoon?
She didn't even know where to begin in telling him everything that had happened to her. And she knew he wouldn't believe her anyway. He would think it was just another one of her cockamamie stories.
Got terribly lost, she said, shaking her head in shame. And it was the truth.
Tears streamed down her face.
But you're all right, he said, looking her over. Where's it hurt?
Just want to get home, she said,
burying her head in the folds of his cloak. She remembered how angry she'd been at him for not telling her about her birth, and how she'd convinced herself that he wasn't on her side. But she realized now how foolish she'd been. Nobody in the world had ever done more for her than her pa, and nobody in the world had ever loved her like he did. When the wolves across the river exploded into howls, it made her pa flinch. He looked around.
I hate wolves,
he said with a shudder as he put his arm around her shoulders and pulled her along.
Come on, we've got to get out of here.
She happily went with him. But as the wolves continued their howling, it sounded different to her than it had before. The howls weren't the lonely, searching calls spread across the vast distances of mountain ridges, but excited yip howls, all from the same location. She couldn't help but feel that they weren't howls of menace, but of joy and reunion.
You made it, brother.
She thought of the wounded red wolf crossing the river.
You made it home.
Her paw held the lantern out in front of them as they traveled, like a guide leading them through the night. She was glad to let him lead the way.
You got to the river and followed it like I taught you,
he said as they walked. I wouldn't have made it otherwise, she said. Soon, they left the trees of the forest behind them and then continued for another mile. Finally, they climbed up the bank of the great river and saw the Biltmore Mansion shining in the moonlight on the high ground in the distance. They still had a ways to go, but at least she could see it now. The faint smell of wood smoke drifted on the cold winter air and filled her with a powerful longing for home. The local folk called the magnificent house the Lady on the Hill, and tonight she could see why. Biltmore looked majestic with her light gray walls and slate-blue rooftops, her chimneys and towers stretching upward, and the reflection of the moon glistening on her gold and copper trim, like something out of a fairy tale. Serafina had never been so glad to see her home in all her life. Her paw took her gently by the shoulders and looked into her face.
I know you're drawn to the woods, Sarah, he said. You've always been pulled by your curiosity. But you've got to stay out of there. You've got to keep yourself safe.
I understand, she said.
She sure couldn't argue with him that it wasn't dangerous.
I know you're good in the dark, he said. Best I ever seen. But you gotta resist the urges, Sarah. You're my little girl. I'd hate to lose you all the way.
When he said all the way, it haunted her. She realized then that he felt like he was already losing her. She could hear the despair in the raggedness of his voice and see it glistening in his eyes as he looked at her. This was his greatest fear. Not just that she would be hurt or killed in the forest, but that her wildness would draw her in. That she'd become more and more wild. More wild than human. She looked up at him and met his small brown eyes, and saw the reflection of her amber eyes in his.
I'm not gonna leave you, Pa, she promised.
He nodded and wiped his mouth.
Come on, then, he said, wrapping his arm around her. Let's get you home and dry, and get some supper in you.
By the time they reached the mansion, the workers had come in from the farms and fields. Most of the mansion's doors had been closed up and locked. The shutters and shades had been drawn against the demons that lurked in the night. As Serafina and her pa headed for the basement, she was surprised to see that the stables were filled with people and activity. Oil lamps glowed brightly in the night. She and her pa couldn't help but pause to see what the commotion was about. A returning mounted search party, a dozen riders strong, stormed into the inner courtyard, filling the air with the clatter of horse hooves striking the brick paving. They'd been looking for Clara Brahms and the other victims. As the riders dismounted and the stablemen hurried out to tend to the horses, the parents of the missing children gathered around. Nolan's pa, who was the stable blacksmith, begged for news of his son, but the riders shook their heads. They'd found nothing. Poor Mr. Rostanov was there as well, struggling to ask questions in his Russian-hindered English, as he held on to his daughter's little white dog. The shaggy creature barked incessantly, growling at the horses as if chastising them for the failure of the search. Watching Mr. Rostanov the Brahmses and Nolan's paw in their desperate struggle to find their children, Serafina's heart filled with an aching sadness. It made her guts churn to think about it, to think about her part in it all. She had to find the man in the black cloak.
"Come on,"
her pa said as he pulled her away.
"This whole place is coming apart at the bolts. Equipment breaking for no reason, folks losing their children. It's a bad business all around."
As they ate their dinner together, huddled around their little cook fire in the workshop, her pa talked about his day.
"I've been working on the dynamo, but I can't figure out how to fix it. The floors upstairs are pitch black. The servants had to pass out lanterns and candles to all the guests, but there weren't enough of them to go around. Everyone's frightened. With all the guests in the house and the disappearance of the children, this couldn't have come at a worse time."
She could hear the pain in his voice. "What are you going to do, Pa?"
"I've got to get back to it," he said.
It was only then that she realized that he'd stopped his work in order to look for her.
"And you need to go to bed. No hunting tonight. I mean it. Just hunker down and keep yourself safe."
She nodded her head. She knew he was right.
"No hunting," he said again firmly.
Then he grabbed his tool bag and headed out. As her father's footsteps receded down the corridor, heading for the stairs that led down to the electrical room in the sub-basement, she said, "You'll figure it out, Pa. I know you will." She knew he would never hear the words from so far away, but she wanted to say them anyway. She found herself sitting alone in the workshop. The man in the black cloak had taken a victim each night for the last 2 nights in a row. With the dynamo broken, she imagined him walking through the darkness of Biltmore's unlit corridors tonight, with a crooked smile on his face. It was going to be easy pickings for him. She sat on the mattress behind the boiler. When she was out on the mountain ridge in the rain, this was all she wanted, to be dry and well-fed and comfortable in her bed. But now that she was here, it wasn't where she wanted to be. Her pa had told her to go to sleep, and she knew she should. Her body was tired and sore, but her mind was a swirl of memories and sensations, hopes and fears. There was only one person in the world who would believe what had happened to her in the forest that day. There was only one person who'd understand everything she'd been through. And he lived in a room on the second floor at the far end of the house. She missed him. She was worried about him. And she wanted to see him. When she and Braden were stranded in the carriage, they were together. They were on the same side. They were as close could be. But now that they were both back home again, he in his bedroom and she in the basement, he seemed farther away than when she was lost in the mountains. There were too many forbidden stairs and doors and corridors between them.
"They ain't our kind of folk, Sarah,"
her pa had said. And she could only imagine what Mr. and Mrs. Vanderbilt would say about her if they knew she existed. Using a wet rag she found in the workshop, she tended to her wounds and cleaned herself up the best she could. Although she lived in a dirty place filled with grease and tools, she liked to keep herself clean, and her adventure in the mountains had left her as muddy as a mud puppy on a rainy day. She took off her wet clothes, wiped her face and neck, her hands and arms, and all the way down her legs until she was spotless once more. When she was done, she changed into a dry shirt. But she'd lost her only belt. She found an old leather machine strap on one of the shelves and used a knife to slice it lengthwise so that it was about an inch wide. She poked holes in it and cut thinner strips of leather to fasten it. When she was done, she cinched the leather belt around her waist to see what it looked like on her. She was so thin that she could wrap it around her waist twice, but she thought it looked very nice. If her pa had been there, he would have said that it made her look halfway to half-grown. She had always wanted to wear a dress, too, like all the other girls, but she'd never been able to find a discarded one, and she didn't think it was right to steal one. For now, she was happy with her new belt. She bowed and pretended she was a young woman meeting a friend at the market. She smiled and twittered and pretended to tell a story that made her friend laugh. Somewhere between washing the blood and mud off her face and seeing herself in her new belt, she decided that if she could survive a haunted forest, find her way through a misty cemetery, and narrowly escape a highly perturbed mountain lion, then maybe she could sneak into a Vanderbilt's bedroom while he was sleeping. One way or another, she needed to solve the mystery of the man in the black cloak. And that wasn't going to get done with her taking a nap behind the boiler. The man in the black cloak was going to walk again tonight. He was going to take another child. She was sure of it. And the one he wanted was Braden Vanderbilt. She had to protect him. The house was quiet and dark. There was a palpable fear in the air. With no electric lights, the Vanderbilts and their guests had gone to bed early, holing up in the safety of their rooms next to their small brick fireplaces. A once bright and grand home had been robbed of light and had become a dark and haunted place. She knew Mr. Vanderbilt's room and Mrs. Vanderbilt's room were both on the second floor, connected by the oak sitting room, where they shared their breakfast each morning. She didn't want to go anywhere near there. She turned left down the corridor toward the southern end of the house, where she knew Braden's bedroom overlooked the gardens. She crept past door after door, but they all looked annoyingly similar. Finally, she came to one adorned with a running horse carved in relief in its center panel, and she smiled. She'd found him. Crouched outside Braden's door, she realized that the real risk she faced wasn't just that someone would catch her, but that Braden wouldn't want her there. He hadn't invited her to his room that night. He hadn't even said he wanted to see her ever again. What if her whole theory of their friendship had been pure and utter imagination on her part? What if he was glad to get rid of her in the forest that morning? Maybe he didn't want anything to do with her anymore. He certainly wouldn't want her sneaking into his room late at night. So she devised a plan. She would peek in, and if her presence there didn't feel right, she'd turn tail quick as a wink. She slowly turned the knob and pushed on the door. When she slipped inside the room, Braden lay fast asleep in his bed. He lay on his stomach beneath several layers of blankets, his cheek against the white pillow, his arms up around his head. He looked plumb tuckered out, like there wasn't anything in the world that could wake him. And she was glad that he was able to sleep. Gideon slept on the floor beside him. She was relieved to see that they were both safe. Sensing her entrance, Gideon opened his eyes and growled. "Shh," she whispered.
"You know me."
Gideon's ears went down in relief when he recognized her voice, and he stopped growling.
"Now that's a good dog," she thought.
and it was a pretty good sign that her hopes for friendship with Braden weren't on the completely wrong mountaintop. She'd get a chuckle out of that, if she became friends with the dog but not the boy. She gently closed the door behind her and locked it.